discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Hello, and it's a good afternoon to wherever you're watching here from Australia. And of course, good evening and good morning from around the world. Thank you for joining us today here on Weekends with Jason Olborn. You're watching and listening to TNT. Now, it is a very, very sad and somber occasion for us here in New South Wales because of the attacks that we saw yesterday in Bondi Junction, Westfield. Our hearts go out to the victims, the families, the friends of those who have lost loved ones, been attacked, or have just suffered through knowing what's going on here. And as everyone would know, Australia is a country that doesn't have guns like you might expect in other countries. Post-1996 Port Arthur massacre, where John Howard, the then Prime Minister, issued a buyback scheme, and it took many, many weapons off the streets, particularly those that were unregistered. So a knife attack, or it could be anything that would cause, that could cause something as horrific as what's going on. Now, there is a lot that we're going to get through today, and as news breaks, we'll bring that to you and possibly even interrupt the planned interviews that we have for you, and they're terrific interviews today. I also want to draw your attention to Iran having launched an attack against Israel using hundreds of suicide drones. Israel has confirmed. Axios journalist Barak Ravid, citing a senior Israeli official, reported hundreds of drones were headed to Israel. Other reports said there were dozens. Iran launched UAVs from its territory towards the territory to Israel, according to Daniel Hagari, who is the Israeli military spokesman. And he said that they are in close cooperation with the US and partners in the region in order to act against launches and intercept them. We know from around 9 a.m. Israeli armed radio reported more than 100 drones that were intercepted. Separate reports saying that the U.S. had shot down an undisclosed amount of Iranian drone aircraft headed towards Israel. So we'll keep you going with what's happening down there. And also out of Iran, comments coming from Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashatani said any nation that helps Israel mount an attack against Iran will face serious consequences. His statement came as Tehran launched those that airstrike against Israel in what it called retaliation for an Israeli attack. So we are dealing with some very, very heavy news this weekend. And for those that are watching this show, know that we concentrate on what I would call both sides of the fall of the Roman Empire, all the events leading up to what is coming in what many perceive as an inevitable collapse one way or another, to see a descent into absolute tyranny. But should the truth get out, and what's the point of doing the work that we're doing and that our guests are doing, and then what you are doing, watching and listening and sharing on social media and talking to family and friends, if we can't get to a point that all of the tyranny that we're up against is not addressed and there is said fall of Rome and the truth is to get out, then what? What do we do in a new world when the bad guys are no longer? What kind of world do we want? What kind of peace do we seek, to grow, to quote JFK, and therefore, where do we head? So we will continue always on this show to bring you, as I said, the best guests that we can get access to bring us stories of both sides. So on today's show, very interesting show for you, the second hour, Ralph Epperson will be joining me. He's been an author for many, many years, a historian. He provides a conspiratorial view of history. That doesn't mean a conspiracy theorist. It means that when two or more people get together to plan something, his argument is that it's not accidental, and we'll examine what Ralph's got to say. Kent Heckenlively will be here in the third hour to talk about not only his new book, he's taken a turn, he's a prolific best-selling author, but he's taken a turn into a novel, with a wonderful historical novel, and we'll tie that in, how he got there, with also the work that he's done, including writing with Judy Mikovits and other incredible people about his work in the medical field. And he's considered by many to be not liked here in Australia. He wasn't allowed to come into our country for his views on vaccines. We'll talk about that as well. And the final hour, Dr. William Mackus will be here to talk about some incredible work, including what he's now discovered as H5N1 as a possible disease X, along with his work in disclosing what's happening towards turbo cancers, cancer treatments, etc. He's an oncologist, radiographer, who has diagnosed some 20,000 cancer patients, and what he's seeing is something that has never been seen before. Well, my first guest this hour is Stephen Mosher, and let me tell you, you are going to love Stephen if you have seen him before on Compass when we were doing that show last year, or perhaps somewhere else. But Stephen is an international authority on China and population issues, president of the Population Research Institute and author of the best-selling book, Bully of Asia, Why China's Dream is the New Threat to World Order. Now, back in 1979, Stephen was the first American social scientist to visit mainland China, where he had access to government documents and actually witnessed women being forced to have abortions under the one-child policy. Frequently testifies before Congress. He's been published in Breitbart, National Review, The Wall Street Journal, The New York Post, and his latest just-released book is called The Devil and Communist China. Stephen Mosher, welcome back to TNT and welcome to Weekends.
Yeah, it's good to be here with you again, Jason.
It's a delight to have you on the show, Stephen, and your book, once again, just your reputation precedes you. It's a wonderful piece that gets into the nitty-gritty of the detail. As I said to you in the pre-production before the show, the devil is in the detail. The devil is also in the title. Now, you have written many, many books now on this particular subject. What was the prompt to go again and to put this book together?
Well, I've talked in the past about the ideology that drives communism in China, and I've written books on it. I've written a couple of books on the history of the People's Republic of China, and of course, the Chinese Communist Party fabricates both. I mean, the history of the People's Republic of China, going back to the founding of the Chinese Communist Party in the early 1920s, is a fabrication. And of course, communism itself, the idea that the state one day is going to wither away and that everyone will be equal and everyone will work as hard as they can according to their ability and provide to everyone according to their needs, is a fantasy that is used by power-hungry megalomaniacs to convince the masses to follow them. Now, the Communist Party itself admits this, all right, in a directive published back in 2013, as soon as Xi Jinping took power. They identified seven perils to the Chinese Communist Party. Now, five of those perils were things you might expect. They were things like the rule of law, right? A representative democracy, freedom of speech, all those things that they associate with, you know, Western democracies, they reject as a threat to Communist Party rule, and quite rightly so, because if there were a free election, they'd be voted out of power. But the other two things they mentioned were an accurate accounting of the history and an accurate accounting of the ideology of the Chinese Communist Party is a mortal peril to the continued rule of the Chinese Communist Party. Imagine that. They admit in a secret communist document, I believe it's directive number 9 of the Central Committee of 2013, that if they told the truth about the history and if they told the truth about the ideology, the people might rise up and throw them out of power. So I've written about the history and the ideology, but I really wanted to take a more personal and even a more spiritual bent this time to talk about what drives men like Mao Zedong and his clone, the second Red Emperor, Xi Jinping, to seek total control over the Chinese people. What drives the structure? What is the fuel that feeds the structure of the Chinese Communist Party that enables it to continue to operate decade after decade, targeting one group after another? Maybe today, landlords, maybe tomorrow, counter-revolutionaries, however that's defined. And of course, for 35 years, targeting the unborn and the one-child policy, now targeting minorities, especially Uyghurs, along with Christians and everybody else. I mean, what drives the system and what drives the leaders of the system to behave the way they do? So at one level, you know, it's kind of a character study of Chairman Mao, comparing and contrasting him to the way that human beings should behave, right? According to the natural law, we know that we should not lie and cheat and steal or kill. I think that's written in the human heart. And even in Buddhism and in Confucianism, you see elements of that, right? The Buddhist respect for human life, the Buddhist admonition against lust, the Buddhist admonition against taking things that don't belong to you, and the Confucian respect for authority and respecting your parents and so forth. So I tried to hold up Chairman Mao against these universally understood goods that every human being should possess and every human being should practice. And boy, does he come out wanting, Jason. This is one of the most evil men who ever lived. In whatever respect of his, whatever aspect of his behavior you look at, he always seems to choose evil over good. And of course, he even openly admitted that communism was not love, he once gloated. He said, communism is a hammer that we use to crush the enemy. And coming from someone who wielded the hammer of communism so effectively that he became the greatest mass murderer in human history, you know, Mao's description of communism as a hammer that we use to crush the enemy should give us all pause, especially now because we're no longer talking so much about traditional economic-based communism. We're talking about cultural Marxism. We're talking about dividing us not on the basis of whether or not we own property, but on the basis of the degree of melanin in our skin or our ethnicity or our race or our creed or our religion. And those are all ways of dividing and conquering and overwhelming societies that we used very effectively in China to seize and are still being used today to hold power.
Now, you brought up before when we're talking about the one-child policy, and I know I'm putting the cart before the horse in our discussion today, but I think that this is such a big deal to bring up now. When we consider COVID, and I know you are scathing against China for its role, and that's putting it mildly, to summarize it, if the virus was created in Wuhan in China and was let out, and the term accidental is a fallacy. You don't make something to accidentally let it out. So therefore, there's some sort of plan involved. If this was all to lead us down a pathway to take lives, which seems to be something that they have form with, therefore, if we consider a depopulation policy, I just want to plant that there, a depopulation plan currently in the world, just lay that there for the moment. I then want to go and then go back to the one-child policy. And Stephen, you are probably the only person that I've ever spoken to that makes the statement that you have witnessed abortions as a part of a one-child policy. What I'm trying to get to here, is this the same level of evil as a depopulation policy? If the powers that be are absolutely convinced that there are too many people on Earth, why didn't the whole world, for example, adopt a one-child policy for a period of 50 years and therefore bring it back and reset it however they're going to do it, which comes with its own problems, or do what we're going through now at this particular process? I'm just trying to lay it out from your perspective.
Yeah.
Is it all evil? Is the term depopulation one of the worst possible things you could come up with? Can this ever be managed?
Well, all right, Jason, that's a pretty big question. Preceding that, you ask about the pandemic in Wuhan. And I just have to say, having written a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to Pandemics, that I went last year all over Australia to talk about, I have to tell your listeners that China actually has released four pandemics on the world. In 57, the Asian flu. In 67, 68, the Hong Kong flu. In 2002, 2003, SARS-1, and then COVID in 2019, 2020. And what I mean by those earlier three is those were all viruses that were not manufactured in the lab. We didn't have the genetic engineering capability in the 50s, 60s, and even 20 years ago to do that. They were true zoonoses. They came from animals, made the jump to humans, and then caused an epidemic in China, which the Chinese Communist Party deliberately had hit from the world. The Asian flu spread from Hong Kong to Singapore and throughout the rest of the world, killed people. The Hong Kong flu started in China, spread to Hong Kong and other parts of the world, killed a lot of people. SARS-3 started in Hong Kong, started spreading to Hong Kong. Fortunately, Canadian intelligence intercepted transmissions in China, electronic transmissions about a new and deadly epidemic that was killing 11% of the people it infected. And we called up the Chinese, and the Chinese Communist Party officials finally admitted, yeah, they had a new and dangerous virus on the loose. That's three times. So COVID is the fourth time. So there's a pattern of abuse here. There's a pattern of covering up epidemics in China and allowing them to spread around the world. So I hold China to account, not just for the coronavirus, which was by far the most deadly, but for the previous three as well. And yeah, we have to be on the lookout. And as far as the Chinese Communist Party, which I believe is the biggest killing machine in human history by far, because if you total up the number of deaths attributable to the Chinese Communist Party, it comes up to about 100 million, tens of millions in the Chinese Civil War, where the Chinese Red Army was blockading food from going into cities and literally starving hundreds of thousands of people to death to get the cities to surrender. Then there was the land reform, the killing of the landlords, rich peasants, killing of everyone associated with the nationalist regime, the anti-rightist campaigns of 57, 58, the Great Leap Forward, where peasants who didn't want to join the communes were tortured and killed. And then after they joined the communes and the communes failed to produce food because of Chairman Mao's mismanagement of the economy, you had 2 years, 3 years of famine in which 45 million people died. The worst famine in human history was man-made. You might say it was Mao-made because it was made by Chairman Mao's mistakes. And then you went into the Cultural Revolution with millions of more deaths. And then in 1980, when I was in China, the one-child policy began. Now, I made the point earlier that the machine of hate that the Chinese Communist Party runs feeds on victims. There has to be a target for the machine to operate effectively. There has to be a group of people targeted, isolated, and then punished, tortured, and even executed in order to keep the machine in running order, to maintain the muscular tone of the system that controls the people. And who became the targets in 1980? It was unborn children. Women were arrested in the commune I was living in and charged with the crime of being pregnant, Jason. They had been illegally conceiving second and third and fourth children up to March of 1980, when a directive came down. The local Communist Party secretary brought it to my house I was living in and showed it to me. And the directive said that all women who were carrying illegal children, you know, should be taken to study sessions and told, for the good of the country, for the good of the party, for the good of China's future, for the good of the commune, they should abort their children. So the system had targeted a new group of people, innocent unborn children. Those women who were arrested were told they had no choice but to get an abortion. In my hearing, I was at the meetings that went on for days and days. And one by one, these young women, they were mostly in their early 20s, mid-20s, late 20s, pregnant with second or third or fourth children, were taken in under escort to the local medical clinic, where they were taken and given lethal injections into the womb. And then 24, 48 hours later, were taken into the operating room and given cesarean section abortions. They were opened up like tin cans, cesarean section, not used to deliver the baby safely, which is what cesarean sections were invented for, beginning at the time of Caesar, which is why they're called cesarean sections. They were used to deliver these now dead and dying babies. I was in the operating room when the lethal injections were being given. I was in the operating room when the cesarean section abortions were taking place. And I must tell you, I had never, as a young man, thought about the abortion question before, but witnessing the forced abortion of a woman at 6 or 7 or 8 or even 9 months pregnant would be enough to make anyone understand that this is the taking of a life of a tiny human being who's done nothing to deserve the death sentence, a total innocent. But this went on for 36 long years. It only ended in 2016. So for 36 years, 400 million abortions, the enemies of the state were what? Unborn children. It was the unborn children who were going to prevent China from becoming a modern industrialized country capable of achieving hegemonic dominance over the entire world. Just as in previous years, it had been the landlords or the counter-revolutionaries or the rightists in the Cultural Revolution who were standing in the way of progress. For 36 long years, it was unborn children. 400 million of the most productive, enterprising, hardworking people in the world were killed off by the Chinese Communist Party. So add up the 100 million to the 400 million, and you get a truly breathtaking death toll of people killed in one way or another by the Chinese Communist Party of about 500 million, which is greater than the population of the United States, Canada, England, and Australia, New Zealand combined. The yes. Greatest killing machine in human history.
It's absolutely extraordinary, and as you said, breathtaking. Now, we do have to go to our first break, and before we do, did you know that there are many ways you can watch or listen to TNT? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet, or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on X, YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey. We've got you covered on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT is an independent global news talk station that does what others only say they do. TNT is a live radio and TV broadcaster that simply tells the truth 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. No one in the world does what we do, crisscrossing the globe, providing credible news and opinion all day and all night. In 2.5 years, TNT has become a credible and exciting platform with brilliant hosts and staff. It's a critical time, and we must continue to call out the misinformation and propaganda from mainstream media and their powerful sponsors. We're now appealing to our many friends and supporters around the world to go to tntradio.live and make a small donation to TNT while we seek the right investors to continue our important mission.
Caution. You are about to hear
today's news talk and the voice of freedom.
That's what this country's all about.
TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour is author Stephen Mosher. His brand new book, The Devil and the Communist Party. Goodness me, did I get that right, Stephen? I think I stumbled over the last bit. Sorry, The Devil and Communist China, I beg your pardon, is the title.
It was The Devil and Communist China. We thought about calling it The Devil and the Communist Party. We thought about calling it The Devil and Chairman Mao, but we called it The Devil and Communist China from Mao down to Xi, because we wanted to emphasize that Xi Jinping is cut from the same cloth as his idol, Mao Zedong.
It is really, really interesting, isn't it, when you can draw these comparisons. And it seems that the introduction of private property ownership in China was a turning point. But then when the Chinese Communist Party's policy is that this would only be for the benefit of the party, therefore it's just another tool to use capitalism in a way to build motivation and incentive, et cetera, only for the spoils effectively to be taken away. And then you've made reference in the recent article that you wrote in the New York Post about a huge proportion of Chinese properties remain vacant. And I was hoping that you could sort of provide a contemporary perspective on this particular article that you wrote in relation to Xi's policies.
Yeah, it's very interesting that this is something that's happened again and again in communist regimes. It happened in the Soviet Union and with the new economic policy in the 1920s, way back a century ago, when Lenin moved towards full war communism overnight, and the Russians were quite starving to death within a couple of years, and so he had to bring back the capitalists. He had to encourage people to create wealth. And so a new group of capitalists came forward, started businesses, got the food supply back running smoothly, saved the country from famine, only to be killed off 10 years later by Stalin when he moved again down the socialist road to ruin. Now, that's exactly what has happened in China. You see, because it took a little longer in China because Mao got into power in 1949, established the People's Republic of China. And then through the series of political campaigns that we talked about, really endless campaigns, one after another, sometimes simultaneously three or four going on, targeting this or that group through the 50s and 60s and into the mid-70s. By the time Mao died in 1976, Chinese society, the Chinese economy, the Chinese government, such that it was in shambles. And Deng Xiaoping, who had twice been sent into exile for opposing radical forms of communism, came back and said, you know, we've got to save the country from absolute collapse. And that's when the four modernizations came into play, right? He was going to modernize science and technology and agriculture and the military. Well, the military certainly worked well. But he allowed the people to fend for themselves. Now, you're talking about the Chinese people, who are among the most entrepreneurially minded, hardworking people in the world. If you give them half a chance, they will improve the lives for themselves and for their families. And that's what they did in the 80s and 90s. The communes were dissolved. When I was in China, the commune I was in, Junan Commune, Equality Commune is the best translation of Junan Commune. So it was a perfect name for a commune. Equality Commune was dissolved. And the villagers, the farmers, were given back the land, except they weren't given back the land. The land was simply leased to them for a certain period of time. So the government still owns all the land in China. But because they were able to farm their own parcels of land, food production skyrocketed. China stopped having to import food for a while. The same thing happened in the private sector in terms of people opening stores, people opening shops. And especially in the export sector, But the other thing that happened, of course, was the United States, believing that we could provoke political change by allowing economic development in China. That is, economic reform would lead to political reform. That was the argument we heard in the early 80s. And I bought it for a while. We opened our markets to China. We opened our markets, the biggest consumer markets in the world, to cheap Chinese goods. We also allowed technology transfer to China, of course, which was promptly aided by, from the Chinese point of view, by massive theft of technology. And of course, we transferred, we invested billions of dollars, hundreds of billions of dollars into China and transferred our cutting edge technology there. So we enabled the rise of China, which is probably one of the greatest strategic blunders in human history now that we look back at it. We enabled the rise of the country that wants to destroy us and replace us as the dominant power in the world. But that rise from the 80s to the 90s and to the early years of this century ended with the ascension of Xi Jinping to power. I think Xi Jinping in 2012, the end of 2012 and 2013, when he became the General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party and the General Secretary of the Central Military Commission and the head of government, I think he thought he had won by then. We had Obama as the president who was busy giving away the store, weakening our military, waffling on Taiwan and so forth. And I think that Xi Jinping thought he had won. And so it was time, he thought, to move towards full-blown communism. And he was actually giving secret speeches at the time saying that it was time to move on to a more socialist system and leave capitalism behind. And that's exactly what he did. One of the things that he did was he put in place a plan to rein in wealth creators. I don't want to call them capitalists because that has sort of a bad ring to it to some people. They're wealth creators. They create wealth, they create jobs, they create economic growth. So he decided to target wealth creators. And so he ordered that members of the Communist Party be allowed to join the board of directors of every major and mid-sized company, private company in the country. Okay. Now, these Communist Party members were what? They were the equivalent of political commissars in the military. In the military, you have political commissars to watch over the generals to make sure they don't get any ideas about staging a coup and follow the party line. By putting political commissars on the boards of directors of private companies in China, it had the same effect. The chairman of the board, the CEO, the billionaire who owned the company, all of those people were now under watch and effectively demoted. Because if I'm sitting in a board meeting and I'm the chairman and sitting across from me is the political commissar representing the Chinese Communist Party that can arrest me and shut me down in a second. I'm no longer in charge. I take orders from that guy. And so that's what happened. Now, Xi Jinping had been at pains to point out that he didn't mind people getting wealthy. Famous quote of his, I don't mind people getting wealthy as long as they use their wealth to serve the party. Okay. Well, the political commissars, it didn't take them long to figure out that the best way that they could make sure that the wealthy person in question would use their wealth to serve the party was to steal it from them, accuse them of corruption, take their company over and expropriate the company and expropriate the wealth. And so that means that the most dangerous place to be in the world today as a billionaire is China. Literally tens of thousands of CEOs and very wealthy men, including a couple hundred billionaires, have disappeared in China. They've been arrested. They've been charged with corruption. They've been sent to prison or even executed. And some of them have been suicided, which is where you just happen to fall off the balcony on the 25th floor of a high-rise apartment building to your death in mysterious circumstances. And so this has been going on now for several years. And this is one of the reasons why China's economy is now in such bad shape, headed downward. It's only one of the reasons. The other reason is demographic. We already talked about 400 million missing Chinese. Half the last two generations never saw the light of day because they were killed in utero. Well, some of them were killed by infanticide after birth, to be sure. And you can't destroy that much human capital and not pay a price. China's paying a price now. The population is in absolute demographic decline. That means they're filling more coffins than cradles each year. Don't welcome immigrants. No one wants to immigrate to China anyway. And so the population is aging and dying more rapidly than any human population is aging and dying. So you've got Xi Jinping leading the country merrily down the socialist road to ruin one more time. You've got the demographic collapse of the country. And of course, you've got the other thing that's in play here is Donald Trump's tariffs, because he put tariffs on Chinese goods back in 2018. And to my great surprise, because I was expecting him to remove the tariffs, Joe Biden has kept the tariffs in place. He hasn't increased them, which he should, but the tariffs have also set China back. And so you're looking now at a Chinese economy where the domestic economy is failing, okay? The domestic economy is in the tank. You've got 65 million homes. One out of every five homes in China is empty, okay? And then you've got tens of millions of people who put down money to buy an apartment that will never be built. It's still an empty plot of land, or it's a shell of a building, a high-rise apartment building with no windows, doors, or any of the internal fixtures put in. It'll never be complete because the company that was building it went bankrupt. Evergrande, the largest company in China, property developer in China, has gone bankrupt. Others are following left, right, and center. So they've lost their, these tens of millions of Chinese have lost their life savings. You know, you can't invest in the stock market in China because most people are a little wary of that anyway, because the government manipulates it. The whole domestic sector of the economy, Jason, was a strangely over-reliant on property development anyway. And the reason that happened is, I mentioned that the farmers don't own the land in China, right? The land is owned by the state. So what local leaders would do throughout China for the last 30 years is this. They would decide that that village right outside the city that they were the head of was sitting on very valuable land. And so they took the land from the villagers. They brought in the bulldozers and bulldozed the village. And then in its place, they built a high-rise apartment building, which they then expected the villagers to move into and pay them rent. Now, who was involved in the scam? Well, the local party official who expropriated the land, the local property developer who would build the project, and of course, the local People's Bank, state-run bank manager who would be in on the scam. So they would all work together. They would all become wealthy, while the homes that the villagers had lived in for, you know, maybe 50, 100 years were destroyed, and the villagers were then turned into renters who didn't own their own homes anymore and really didn't have any land to farm either. That happened again and again throughout China. And that was such a productive scam that generated so much in the way of illicit profits that it went on to the extent where you've got the 65 million empty apartments in China today. The overbuilding continued. China, over the past few years, poured more concrete than the United States did in the last century of development. The overbuilding went on at such a frenetic pace. Well, now that's all done. And 40% of the domestic economy is gone, just like that. Then you've got the export sector of the economy, which is the only sector of the economy that works according to market principles. But the major companies in the export sector now, of course, are being taken over by the state gradually because of the political commissars sitting on the boards of directors. So the economic problems of China are really, I think, sending China into irreversible decline. And then you've got Xi Jinping himself, who is aging, and just he's following the same path as Chairman Mao, who, as he grew older, became increasingly paranoid and suspicious of those around him. Mao became so suspicious, of course, that during the Cultural Revolution, he had his right-hand man, Liu Shaoqi, who'd been the head of government, killed. He had General Peng Dehuai, who during the Chinese Civil War had saved his life on not one but two occasions, killed, tortured to death by the Red Guards who answered to Chairman Mao. And he even had his longtime premier, Zhou Enlai, who had faithfully served him from 1935 Sun Yi Conference on as his second premier for decades. In 1970, 2002, the doctors came to Chairman Mao and said, Premier Zhou has bladder cancer. You see, because the doctors were under orders to keep track of the medical conditions of all the Politburo members and report only to Mao after a health exam was done. That's one of the ways he controlled them. So the doctors came to Mao and said, Chairman Zhou has bladder cancer. And Mao said, don't tell him he has bladder cancer. Don't treat it. Allow it to go on. And that's what they did. You see, Mao didn't want Zhou Enlai to outlive him. He'd become so paranoid in his old age. And so Zhou died in 1975 in agony from cancer that had spread throughout his body. And Mao lived on for another year. So that was the kind of person that Mao became in his last years. And you see that same paranoia now expressing itself in Xi Jinping. At the last Party Congress a few months ago, the former president, Hu Jintao, was lifted out of his seat by Xi Jinping's bodyguards and physically led out of the room. Very, very interesting scene there. In front of the assembled 400 members of the Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party, the serving members and the alternate members. Why was he removed from the room? Because he had opened on the last day of the Party Congress the list of members of the new Politburo, and the three people from his faction who were supposed to be on that list weren't there. And so he turned frantically to Xi Jinping and started talking to him about what's going on. And Xi just beckoned to the security and had Hu Jintao lifted out of his seat and taken out of the room. This is the former president of China for 10 years. This is the guy who supported Xi Jinping's rise and supported Xi Jinping as he attacked one faction of the Chinese Communist Party after another, getting rid of all of his political opponents. And then finally, at the end, who does Xi Jinping turn on? He turns on Hu Jintao himself, and he's now busy removing all of Hu Jintao's faction members from their positions in prefectural and county and provincial governments. So there's an ongoing purge within the Chinese Communist Party right now carried out by Xi, who doesn't trust anyone as he gets older.
Just absolutely incredible, an insider's look at what's really going on there. When I say insider, the first social scientist ever to get to China back in 1979 is with us today, Stephen Mosher. We're going to take a quick break and come back with more. Don't go anywhere. You're watching and listening to Weekends with Jason Olborn here on TNT Radio.
Our beautiful world is changing, withering, dying by the hands of those who don't value nature, even though we all depend on it for life itself. But there is hope. Together with caring friends, the Nature Conservancy can restore our lands, heal our waters, and save our wildlife with big solutions only nature can provide. But every day we lose more of the places we love, and we urgently need to save endangered lands, waters, and wild species. The actions we take today will determine the tomorrow we leave to our children and grandchildren. The water they drink, the air they breathe, the beauty they experience. To learn more about how you can help protect and conserve our beautiful world, visit nature.org today.
When the world's endangered animals need help most, when their lives are at greatest risk, when they would otherwise be lost, the International Fund for Animal Welfare is there, taking action to rescue the animals we love, to protect them and their threatened natural habitats. See how you can help animals and people thrive together at joinifal.org.
Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
And welcome back to Weekends. My guest this hour, Stephen Mosher, who is the author of the brand new book, The Devil and Communist China. Wow, the devil and It's just incredible that here it is right there on the screen, The Devil and Communist China. Check it out. You can go online and look at Amazon or various other places. And, of course, you buy hardcover or download it digitally to your Kindle. Definitely worth being able to stay on top of things. And, of course, digital reading at least allows us to cut the budget a little bit and expand our library. I'm just getting used to the idea of reading on my iPad, Stephen, but it does make a difference, and it is a lot more portable than carrying with you a book, and, of course, a lot more affordable, I must say, because there's just so much information that we like to get our access to today, and it does become restricted. Everyone is time poor, as we know. But Stephen, just to continue, and it's a really interesting analysis that you've provided, of course, so far, as you always do. But when we consider the one-child policy, and now we have a different problem in China, is that these days that the birth rate is very, very low, even after the policy has been removed in 2016. It seems that the youth in China are disinterested in the way that the country works, and of course are not having children. So therefore, as president of the Population Research Institute, do you have any reason to doubt the official population numbers that we see in China that are declining, but could they be higher or could they be lower?
Oh, I have no doubt that the official numbers of people in China are an exaggeration. And the reason I say that is because officials at all levels of government massage statistics to make themselves look good. So that if the central government says we're going to have 6% growth in 2024, every provincial party secretary will report 6% or 6.1 or 6.2 or 6.3% growth. No one reports 5.9% growth, because that would be making a liar out of the central government's projections, and it would put a target on your back and lead to your removal as party secretary and the end of your political career. So what always happens is the numbers are increased to either increase the subsidies you get from the central government or to make yourself look good. So think about the position that a principal of a school is in. He gets a subsidy from the government for every pupil he has. So he has an incentive to exaggerate the number of pupils. And especially if he creates a few ghost pupils, that's all money in his pocket. So the number of students is exaggerated. Hospitals get subsidies from the government, depending on how many patients they have and how many births, of course, they oversee. So they naturally may exaggerate the number of births. People who run a factory, or people who run a city, any time that the central government or the prefectural government or the provincial government is dispersing funds, the people in charge of receiving those funds, if they're at all based on the per capita, if they're at all based on the numbers are exaggerated. So I think that the actual population of China is not 1,400 million. I think it's maybe a few tens of millions less. A friend of mine who is a Chinese economist at the University of Michigan thinks the numbers are exaggerated by 100 million. So it may only be 1,300 million. But we know this. We know that the devastation caused by the one-child policy is so great that China is now no longer the most populous country in the world. That has passed to India, not China. And we know also that China's economic prospects are much dimmer because of the aging and dying of the population. You know, it's the young who marry and buy homes and cars and have children and start businesses and with their long time horizons, make investments that possibly go on for decades. The elderly, on the other hand, are drawing down their wealth, using it to maintain their living standard, and they have short time horizons. So China's is without half the last two generations, which also hamstrings the economy. You know, and I lay this at the feet of Chairman Mao, not only because he put in place the Chinese Communist Party, the biggest killing machine in human history, that really feeds on targeting classes, groups of people, and targeted the unborn, as I mentioned, but also because of his total callousness towards human life. Mao actually seems to have celebrated death as a kind of necessary weeding of the human garden. At one point, he said, "What does it matter if a third of the population dies? Their bodies will fertilize the soil. That's what he thought of those he ground into oblivion. They were only useful as human compost. And in 1958, he gave a speech, and the published speech today has this paragraph taken out, but the original speech, which we have a copy of, says this, that we need to put in place, he said, an office of family planning, an office of population planning, because we need to plan births, he said in 1958, the same way that we plan the production of tons of steel and numbers of bicycles. The state needs to be planning births. Well, that advice was not acted on until 1980, but it came originally from Mao. It was Mao Zedong who made it possible for the Chinese Communist Party to start thinking in terms of directly controlling reproduction. And having thought of directly controlling reproduction, they did that to drive birth rates down for 36 years. Now, of course, they're doing it to drive birth rates up. They've been encouraging young people to get married. Now, that's a tough thing to do if the unemployment rate among the young is 40%, which we believe it is. The official statistic is 16%, but just a few months ago it was 21%, and they redefined unemployment so that they brought the number down by 5%. That's just playing with statistics. The actual number is probably 40%. So young people without economic prospects are unlikely to get married. The Chinese government has been, you know, setting up dating apps to match young people together and encourage marriage. The other thing they've done, though, is they've gone further with party members and members of the People's Liberation Army. They've told young members of the People's Liberation Army, young soldiers, sailors, and airmen, that they should marry and have at least three children. They've told young Communist Party members they should marry and have at least three children as well. Now, those two sets of population subsets together won't be enough to offset the population decline. They would have to institute a policy of three children for everyone in China to offset the current population decline. There are so few young women in China, Jason. You remember that one of the side effects, consequences of the one-child policy was massive female infanticide and massive sex selection abortion. In fact, I went to Australia in 1986 at the invitation of Senator Brian Harradine to testify before the Australian Senate about what a bad idea it would be for the Australian aid agency to send 6,000 ultrasound machines to China, because they wouldn't be used to save lives, which is what you might think, right? They would be used to detect the sex of the unborn child. And if the unborn child was a girl, an abortion would almost inevitably follow. And so I said, these machines will be used to perform sex selection abortions. I think the machines were sent anyway, but you know, you do what you can. That was my first trip to Australia. But because of the shortage of young women in China, because the pool of young women is so small, every young woman would have to marry in her early 20s and have three children in order to offset the current population decline. Now, I can't think of any combination of incentives and inducements to make that happen. But I can think that this Communist Party, which did not hesitate to force young women to get abortions, even if they were about to give birth, would not hesitate, if the leaders decided to force young women to get married and to have children. So I hope no one gives Xi Jinping a copy of The Handmaid's Tale, you know, that famous tale about forcing women to have children, because it might give him ideas. Would they hesitate? Would he hesitate to order forced insemination of women in China if he thought that, you know, they thinned the herd too much and they needed to build back up the masses? I don't think he would have any moral compunctions about doing that at all. And I think he would find many willing minions in the Chinese Communist Party to carry out those orders, in the same way they found members of the Chinese Communist Party to carry out the orders to abort women and sterilize them, consequently, for violating the one-child policy.
It doesn't matter whichever way we approach it, all roads seem to lead to China and its population. And of course, as we've discussed in depth on today's show, the idea of the one-child policy, and then of course now going completely flipping it the other way and encouraging families to not have two but three children shows you just how far wrong that previous policy was. But at the same time, we're seeing economic collapse, as it were, in terms of the real estate market for some strange reason still being able to prop up and be disguised. But of course, when you get behind the walls there in China, you see the reality. One in five homes, goodness me, imagine that, just being being vacant. If there's no population to take these homes up, I mean, where is 1.2, 1.3 billion people living there for? And yet there's so many gaps in the argument. Of course, the massaging, as you said, of statistics to represent a particular situation, the following on of the party line, Stephen, the idea that if they predict 6% growth, you come in at 6 or 6.1%, mm-hmm. further manipulation. You wonder at what point, and as you said, a dangerous place for billionaires to be, but at what point does the world start to see what's going on, or is this cover-up something that just continues until an inevitable famine appears out of nowhere and people start asking questions? Would it be, for example, Donald Trump getting re-elected and promising to put a massive tariff on Chinese electric vehicles as another instance that could be blamed, for example? How do you see things playing out if we were to fast forward perhaps 6 months or 12 months even, which isn't very long, to project what might be coming next in terms of China revealing publicly some of the problems that they're actually facing?
Well, I think that the history of the Chinese Communist Party is a fabrication, as I said, quite deliberately, and they will continue to fabricate it to serve their own interests. But the Donald Trump question is interesting because last year he said that when he's back in office, and he has no doubt he will be reelected, and the polls are actually looking that way, by the way, that he will put a 10% tariff on all Chinese goods across the board. That will pretty much short circuit the export sector of the economy and cause tremendous economic problems in China itself, which, you know, exacerbating the existing problems. And might send, you know, China into kind of secular economic decline that it'll have a hard time pulling out of. He would also, of course, continue and accelerate the process of reshoring and moving to friendlier climes production facilities that are currently in China. You know, move them to Australia, for example. Move them back to the United States, Canada, Japan. Let's buy goods from countries that share our values and institutions, and not from a country that that exists and is run by a Chinese Communist Party that wants to that despises those values and wants to destroy those institutions and replace them with a very different system of government. So, that will be a watershed change in U.S. policy. It's not one that Australians should be worried about. I think it's one that Australia should welcome. Because I think that the current feckless, rudderless leadership in Washington, D.C. Has left us in a very, very dangerous time until next January.
Yeah, and that's the way we're seeing very, very similar situation as we observe from around the world. Very busy year with elections coming up all around the planet, but all eyes on the United States as we watch and see what may happen. We've seen conflict situation just breaking out this weekend with Iran sending drones to Israel. Of course, we've got threats from Taiwan with the earthquake and a possible opportunity for China that may or may not act. But this is an interesting point, isn't it, that they seem to bluff their way into pressuring, et cetera, but will they have the wherewithal to want to go and start a conflict with Taiwan? That's something that we're all watching to see which way that will fall. But very interesting take on what's going on. Stephen, I just want to thank you again for your time today. For everyone, the book is called The Devil and Communist China. It's a must read, and that's just scratching the surface today of what Stephen has covered. And please check out Stephen's other books. And of course, best, most economical way to do that is the digital downloads, et cetera. If you'd like to get hold of more than one of these terrific books, and your budget is limited. But Stephen, thank you again for your time today and the work that you continue to do. It's wonderful. Now, we're going to we're going to have to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to have a lot more for you on the other side. You don't want to go anywhere when you're joining Weekends with Jason Olbourne here on TNT.